Okay, this is Jody Stone on the 8th of October, 1992, in the Scoville Library in Salisbury, interviewing Ed Kirby. And that's all I have to say, because I have to ask you your whole name.
My whole name, Edward Maurice Kirby.
And you were born in Sharon?
I was born in Sharon, a native, and I live in Sharon currently. And I was an educator in this area for 35 years. I was in 41 years in education altogether. Currently, I'm doing a lot of geologic field work in the area and writing a field guide to geology of the Upper Housatonic Valley. I worked with Stan in the recent battle we had in Sharon over the potential nuclear dump. I'm chairman of the Sharon Inlands, Wetlands, and Watercourses Commission. I've done a lot of Western writing and geology study in Utah, California, and some other places, and here I am.
What got you going on geology?
I always liked the land, and I guess it's part of the part of the naturalist field that I really like the best. And I think that the fascinating thing about geology is that it's really, to me, the core of everything else. Everything we have grows on our geology, and it's I find it fascinating. And my main interest is geomorphology, form of the land, how it got to be the way it was, and land relating to people.
Did you study this in college? Or
I majored in biology and never taught a day of it in my life, as it turned out. And I've done some graduate work in geology, but most of the geology I have of the Upper Housatonic Valley really comes from just wandering these hills for the past 35 years or so. Actually, I've been active in the geology in the valley and teaching it and studying it since about 1960. Sort of an ongoing thing.
Now, you said earlier this building is made of Stockbridge marble. Is there a quarry still in existence, in use?
There are a number of quarries still in use.
In Stockbridge?
Up and down the whole valley. The quarries that are most active right now are in the Falls Village and Canaan area and in the Lee, Massachusetts area. And there are two big quarries up in Lee.
Where in Lee?
In Lee, right off the... if you look over the edge going along the Massachusetts Turnpike, if you're going all the way to the end, not getting off at Lee, it goes right between two of the quarries, the old one and the new one. You don't see them much as you travel on. Yeah, that's right. But they're right near the center of Lee, and then there's some big ones in North Adams, Massachusetts. I don't deal with those because most of my work is, I'm trying to confine it, the first study I'm doing to the Housatonic Valley watershed. So when I say the Housatonic Valley, I'm talking about the total watershed from about Bulls Bridge in Kent up to Lake Pontusic in Pittsfield. And that's 500 square miles.
And what's east and west boundary?
East and west would be on the opposite side of the Harlan Valley in this area. The Weebatuck Creek system that goes to the south is actually part of the Housatonic watershed. Bashbish Falls isn't. Bashbish Falls flows to the, it's strange geology around here, flows to the west and runs into the Hudson River eventually. That goes through other rivers first. And from here, all the way over into Torrington, that runs down the Naugatuck River, which is a tributary of the Housatonic further south. But once you get in the Winsted area, then you're dealing with the water that runs toward the Farmington River system and the Connecticut Valley system. And so I'm sticking with that, although, we go over the border here and there, where the rocks are essentially the same and it's contiguous with what we have here.
Who's we?
Well, there's some other crazy people that do this too. A lot of the work I've done with Dave Lindsay, who taught with me at the high school in the geology course. He teaches it currently. And Reed Craig and Sharon, who is a professional geologist that's worked all over the world. Essentially, the work I'm doing right now, I'm doing alone in the field.
You're doing this for your own pleasure?
For my own pleasure, and I'm going to print it and make it available to people, and eventually with a booklet. It has it has a narrative text that will include tectonic effects in the Housatonic Valley, a glossary so people can look up some of the words if they trouble them a little bit, the surficial or glacial geology, the ice age in this area, general abstract of which runs from geology into people. So it's a little bit of everything. Sort of a fun project.
Have we ever had an earthquake here?
Oh, yes. We had earthquakes during this century, but not, they were really just rumbles more than anything else. But if you look at this area right here, and look at the St. Andreas Fault and the area in California, the period in time they're in right now, we were in back 400, 500, 600 million years ago, and as recently probably as 250 million years ago. So we're much, much older geology. Let me just give you what I think is a short description. If I use any bad terms, Wei,
I'll ask you.
Help me a little bit. If you look at the total geologic history, it goes back in what we call Precambrian time, very, very ancient times. So I'm going to start with about 1,200 million years ago. That's 1.2 billion years ago. And during that time, we were forming what they call the gneiss complex of the Housatonic Highlands. That's a rock that was a very old rock that was formed originally from some granites and then shales and muds and everything that became schists and formed into a complex, a lot of different kinds of rock. And most of that is over on the east side of the valley. The hill right across from the high school, Barrack Mountain, Sharon Mountain running down south of there, some of the hills, Beartown Mountain up east of Great Barrington, all of those, that's sort of the east wall of the valley, not the watershed. And that was around, existed a long time before any new rocks came in. And then about the beginning of the Cambrian period, which would be 600 million years ago, just a rough figure, we had the shores of the ancient oceans reach the area and deposited beaches, thick beds of sand. So all up and down the eastern side of the valley, we find a tremendous amount of quartzite. And quartzite formed when the sand became sandstone, and then it was metamorphosed, changed by heat and pressure into quartzite. So we find that usually in patches on top of the gneiss, and that was used for firestone in the old furnaces and some of the earlier ones before they got into using more of regular fire brick, which of course is much more effective. And then on top of that, we had shallow lagoons of seas that sort of slipped in, and it was very rich in lime. And from that, we had the lime became so heavy in the water, was in solution, that it precipitated out over thousands and thousands, millions of years, and built up very thick beds of what became a limestone, and then was metamorphosed into a marble. So what we have around here, most of the locals call that rock limestone. Geologically, it's a marble because it has gone through the process of changing it from a limestone to a marble. The difference is strictly semantics; doesn't make that much difference. I make a reference to it as a marble. That probably has the greatest use of through the years of any of the rocks in the valley, any of the separate rock units. And that's part of the carbonate bed that runs from Vermont all the way down through here. The Housatonic follows it almost all the way, except for one or two exceptions down through south of Bull's Bridge. And it's you find it over in the Oblong Valley and the Harlem Valley in New York State as well. And it's a very long, pretty thick bed of good quality marble. Now, if you grind it up, you have lime. You're just changing it back to the stage where it was originally. And it's been used. It was very important in the iron industry, and I'll come back to its use there in a moment. But it became very important in the second half of the 19th century, even the first half of it, as a building construction block, like the building we're sitting in right now is Stoppage marble. Fun to go through towns and see how many marble buildings you can pick out, or limestone if you want to call it that. Great Barrington's a good one. If you come from north to south, you pass the Catholic Church, which is, I think that's been cleaned up some, sandblasted, so the marble looks much whiter there. As it weathers, it gets darker in color. And then there's another church right next to that. You go a little further, then there's another church on the right-hand side. And then across from is the Searles Castle, which is now the John Dewey School or something like that, I believe. And beyond that, there's another church. So they've practically lined their main street with marble. But some of the marble from the East Canaan quarries was used to build the state capitol in Hartford, and the marble from the East Lee quarry up where the turnpike, you get off the turnpike, the old one, the big one now is used for other purposes, that's still active, but the old one up there was the rock from there was sent to New York by train, and they built St. Patrick's Cathedral, and I believe Grace Church down on Broadway, plus a lot of other buildings, the east wing of the United States Capitol is built out of Stockbridge marble. But its use goes on today because it's used for agricultural lime. It's used as the inert filler in vinyl tile. And when you brush your teeth every morning, if you brush your teeth with toothpaste, you undoubtedly are using some Stockbridge marble, which is inert and just is ground up very finely, but acts, when put in with all these other things, acts as a cleaning agent for teeth. So it probably, through the years, has been used more than any other rock. We don't think of ourselves as an industrial rock area, but we kind of are in a way.
What about Canaan? Is that the same thing?
Yeah, that's the same thing. And in fact, that's the one up there where some of that material is coming out and being used for vinyl tiles. The
one. Where does it go? When those trucks come out of there, where are they going?
Oh, they transport it to south, I know, to the New York City area. Some of it's transported to the west. The limestones that are found out in the Ohio Valley and so forth aren't as pure, and they also aren't as hard, so this became much more valuable as a result.
So that quarry's not worked out in Canaan?
Oh, no. Though there's still plenty of Stockbridge marble around. Now, if we go across the street to the watering trough and begin to go up the hill, we get away from the marble underneath, which outcrops in some areas, and then we begin to see some darker rock about a quarter of a mile up the road. You come to a place where there's little dark outcrops on either side. They're very small, and that's Wallumsack Schist, named after Wallumsack and up along the Vermont-New York border. All these things tie in together pretty much, and there's Wallumsack marble and Wallumsack Schist, and the Wallumsack Schist is the rock that Salisbury iron ore comes from. The term Salisbury iron ore to the geologist really includes all the iron ore you find any place from Wingdale, New York, up to Richmond, Massachusetts. I mean, it's just called Salisbury ore. And there's some differences in it, but it's pretty much the same. It's a secondary weathered ore. Most of it's what they call limonite. Some is a variety of that called goethite, after Goethe, the poet, philosopher, scientist. Some of it's brown hematite. But essentially, it's the same thing. It's not a particularly rich ore, but the reason it was so valuable in this area is that the amount of ore, the amount of actual iron in the ore was very high. And it was over 55%. So that really, really is what made it very valuable. Then as we go up the hill further, we're going up Mount Regan now toward the pond and toward the old furnace. On the right-hand side, you have a big, deep ravine that's cut down in there. Now you're into the next rock up. And that's the Everett Schist. A schist starts out as a mud and silt and things like that, and then becomes a shale, then becomes a slate, then becomes a schist. So it's gone through all sorts of metamorphism. Now that's what we call that rock unit, which stretches all the way from, well, down south of here, all the way up to Mount Washington and on up north of there, and probably up even to Mount Greylock area in north of Pittsfield. That's what they call a lacunous type of rock formation. And don't ask me to spell that. And a lacunous means it was formed somebody else, someplace else, and moved here. And that whole rock unit, this is hard to conceive now in the Earth's crust, but that whole rock unit was formed far to the east of here. And then back when we had the continental crashing, when all the plates were moving together, Africa came along and had a run-in with old North America, and push that rock over the top of everything else up on top of that area. So by the time we got down to what they call the, if I can remember the right periods now, the Ordovician period, we had, well, at the end of that, what was called the tectonic uplift, which is an orogeny, an upheaval of all the rocks and everything. Well, this is even in the early stage of the crashing. And it's estimated in studying the conditions and that we see like these in other parts of the world, that the mountains in this area, the tectonic range, was at least 20,000 feet high. So that's your answer to the earthquake. See, now they're going through that in the California area, but here they've obviously worn down. Then they were pushed up again, probably not quite as high, and now have been worn down. So they're high and very beautiful, but they're not real mountains in a true sense. If you start hiking them and you get lost up there, it's hard to believe that they aren't mountains. So that's essentially the rocks that are here in the valley, and that's that whole process of the rock formation probably finished up maybe 350 to 400 million years ago. And since then, we don't have any real big, thick rock units around. So we're still using that old Stockbridge stuff and other things that are lying around. There's very little granite in the area. There's a granite area over in Warren, Connecticut, and a place called Flat Tops Road. I don't know if you're Flat Rock Road. Well, if you drive on Flat Rock Road, you're driving on Tyler Lake granite, and that's the granite right there. And you know, we often read in some of the local literature and so forth these beautiful granite hills and everything else. Well, they're not. They're beautiful schist hills. That doesn't sound too good, I guess. And beautiful Highlands Gneiss hills or something like that. But some of it was, the gneiss was a granite at one time, but it's undergone so many changes, it's really in a metamorphic stage now.
Ed, what is they in front of, in Lakeville, in front of what used to be the apothecary shop, you with me?
Mm-hmm.
The pavement, the sidewalk, has worn there and in front of the liquor store. And under it is what looks like marble.
Stockbridge marble.
They would have used that when they first started paving or making sidewalks.
Or they might have just hit seams of bedrock sticking up there. When I say bedrock, ledge is what most people call it around here.
Yeah.
But it often sticks right up through. They just put some new pipes in Sharon for the, it's tubing for the fiber optics for the telephone lines. And you don't notice the marble as you drive through Sharon. They got down about 6 inches.
Okay.
And they had a blast and used jackhammers and everything else. So in many places it's very close to the surface. Other places it's way below the surface, buried by glacial till. Now we went a long time from 350 million years ago down to the Ice Age. When we drive around, we look at the area, we're really looking more at the effects of the Ice Age, the final veneer, more than anything else. And the Ice Age was the Pleistocene epoch, which started about 2 million years ago. And there's been four major ice advances. And they're named for the states where they were, where the most evidence remains, Nebraska, Kansas, Illinois, and Wisconsin. The Wisconsin was the most recent advance. And that's the one we can study because each one that comes through scrapes out all the rest. So we probably had at least two and maybe three glacial advances here altogether. But the Wisconsin glacier here caused a lot of the rounded hills and a lot of the features that we see today and a lot of things that give the beauty to the land, along with the mountains that stick up and so forth. And the ice really radiated out of the area up just east of Hudson Bay in Canada. And up there was probably about 2 miles thick. And you got these tremendous snow fields, and it pushed out in all directions, went north and east and west as well as south. But of course, we're interested in south because that's where we live from there. And it came all the way down in this area, and the Wisconsin Glacier extended to its terminal moraine, which is Long Island. So Long Island is really, if you drive a spike down on Long Island, unlike driving it down around here, you go 400 to 600 feet before you hit bedrock. That's all. The stuff like a conveyor belt that was carried off the end of the glacier. So it just piled up there and piled up. And so you have the Long Islanders. I used to work down there as a consultant. I used to tell them they live in a pile of glacial garbage, which is not always taken too well, as you might imagine. So the features that we see around here, many of them, especially in the valleys, where you don't see the bedrock, are glacial features. Right in this general area, they were two... They call them temporary glacial lakes. There's glacial lakes like Lakeville Lake and Mudge Pond and Sharon and so forth. I'll come back to those. And they're temporary glacial lakes. And the temporary glacial lakes occurred when the ice had stopped advancing and stopped retreating even, was beginning to stagnate in place. Now, where you're sitting right now, just about in that spot, there was about 3,000 feet of ice on top of that, which is pretty substantial chunk of ice, which covers Mount Riga, obviously, with considerable ice, because, it's 700 feet there and, 16 or something up there. So you've still got a tremendous amount of ice on top of that. Now, the ice sort of rotted in the valleys and then, in some cases, blocked the valleys. So it blocked one of the lakes around here, which is partially in Salisbury because it's lime rock in that area. formed as a result of the blockage in the very narrow section of the river that you go through along Route 7, about 0.3 mile north of West Cornwall. It's narrow. There used to be a bridge that went across there at one time, and it's gone now. And that's where the dam was for one of these glacial lakes. And that dammed it all the way up to the base of Great Falls. And what happened was the ice still sat in the valley. So now you have high hills on either side. And these things were around for 400 or 500 years. So the water and silt and sand and everything else runs down off the top of the hills. And now it's running into a lake, but the lake is filled with this huge block of ice. So it stops the flow of the water, and it just settles down gradually. And as a result, you have a nice terrace, and on it is built the Housatonic Valley Regional High School. And that's that terrace is an old glacial lake terrace between 10 and 11,000 years old. And it's about 50 feet above the floor, above the floodplain of the river. Now, just try and think of that. You got this huge chunk of ice sitting in the middle of the valley there. Now, you scamper across that block of ice, and you get to the other side, and now we call that Lime Rock. You notice if you go along Route 112 from the high school, you go up a little hill, and you go right across a flat area, and that's Lime Rock, and you go down the hill on the other side. And that terrace ran back down the White Hollow Road. But now, when everything melted and all the ice was gone, the Salmon River is working its way down across the terrace, and so, of course, it cut a big hole in it. And that groove you have down through where the straightaway on the Lime Rock track runs now is cut into the old glacial terrace. Now, north of there, at the top of Great Falls, there's a rock threshold. You can't see, it's underwater because of the dam now. And the same thing happened there. And it dammed a lake that reached from there to the Stockbridge border. That's about 20 air miles altogether. So you had this huge glacial lake going through all there. And that one was probably the biggest of the ones in this part of the valley. Of course, the largest one was one they called Lake Hitchcock out in the center of the state. But the Connecticut Valley is much broader. So the one that formed near the high school, that's called Lime Rock Lake. They're not there anymore. Glacially, the next one up was called the Falls Village Lake. Then the one that came through here, let's see now, how can I get you there? You're going from Hoshka School to Lime Rock. You come down the hill by the farms and so forth, and you go down a steep hill, and then you get into an area where the valley's very narrow. It plugged up there, too. See, all this ice is getting carried by running water and everything, so now you plug it up. Now we have another glacial lake. And that glacial lake, I never found the name on it, so I named it. That's the Chenab Brook Glacial Lake, and that really extended right through here. And from the street out here in front of the library, back of the library, till it gradually drops off where you get way back almost toward the ski jump area, that's part of the terrace of that old glacial lake where water was running down against the ice. I think the most fantastic part of it is if you start in, we'll go the other way around, if you start north in South Egremont and drive 41 right down to here, and even a little bit beyond here, you're really driving along the shore of that old glacial lake. You go up and down, you go over little deltas, you go over little caymes. There's one house that sits in Sheffield on the east side of 41, and it sits out in this funny little flat piece of land. It's a barn house. Have you ever seen that out there? Beautiful setting. Well, that was all packed with big ice blocks all around it, so the water ran down and just settled in there. 10,000 years later, it's gone, and you put a nice house on it, and it's really, really very unique.
How do you know it's there?
Well, you learn a lot from the literature that's already been written. Nobody's really written something on this totally. I mean, it's usually done USGS or Connecticut State Geologic Survey or Massachusetts Geologic Survey, but you learn by observing other areas, and you learn by a lot of it studying the land. A lot of it's walking the land. I think the most important thing in geology is being able to sit and just stare at something at a while and go over it over and over and over again. I mean, I've been running up and down Route 41 for I don't know how many years, and really some things have popped out at me just in the last few days because of some additional literature that I read. I could see these things.
Tell me about this tour.
Well, let me do one other thing first, and then come to the tours. To me, one of the fascinating things that it ties in between, I guess, the geology, the geography, and the sociology is man is a product of his of his geology. And I think that becomes very, very evident in this area. The pre-Indians, and they were pre-Indians, and later the early Indians, came in here mainly as, originally as hunters. They came in from the west, and they came over the mountains and came down this area, and the word Housatonic means land beyond the mountains. And I could never figure it out until I found out they're coming from the west, not the east, so that's why it was beyond the mountains. But that was primarily the hunting stage. And then the later Indians that were here and the early white settlers, it was mainly farming. The farmers were a particularly tough crew. I mean, that's to farm around here even today. Well, not many people do anymore, but it was so difficult because of the glacial conditions. Because the glacial features may look nice, but it also carries a lot of rocks and boulders and gave us all those nice stone walls as a result. But it's very tough land to deal with. Land was very forested when they came here. So the farmers began to clear some of the land, which of course decreased some of the hunting, which changed the hunting pattern into farming. During the Revolution, some of the grist mills, like the one over in Ellsworth, was particularly valuable, and the Tories were never able to find it. And we kind of became the breadbasket of the nation at that point, because it wasn't a very big nation, it didn't go very far west. And then from the 1730s up until nearly 1900, it became the industrial area, and a good part of that was of course the iron industry and the things that were related to it. The hills were denuded at that time because in order to have iron industry, you need iron ore and you need charcoal for fuel, and you need limestone carbonate, which was the Stockbridge marble. So it's interesting, the furnace up on top of Mount Riga, you wonder why it's up there. Well, it's up there because the fuel is there. And there's so much more volume to the fuel than there is to the iron ore, even though the ore is heavier. It makes more sense to carry, they had to carry the iron up from Ore Hill, they had to carry the marble up from the quarries over in Falls Village in little carts, and the charcoal was closer to the top of the mountain. They had it right there, and they had the water power, which is the fourth item that they needed. So we went through that sort of an industrial type of stage at that time. Then it settled back with perhaps more agriculture again, and there were a large number of farms at one time, but it started to become more residential. Population in many of these towns was much higher in 1870 and 1880 than it was in 1950, but now it's begin to grow once again. I'm not sure what classification we put in today. It's rural residential. It's a very special area, obviously, and it's still, even though we have a lot of people in it, I think it has a certain kind of isolation that, don't build any more highways or anything else or anything like that. Now, yeah, you asked about, I guess I've covered some of the areas that you could easily visit around here and see. In the tour guide I've set up, I have six basic tours, and these are written, but I'm still polishing them and hope to have something to hand out to have some people check out in the field by next spring. The first tour is a Route 7 tour. You get in your car at Lake Pontusic and you drive right down to Bulls Bridge in Kent. Nothing tricky. You're driving along the Marble Belt most of the way, and it's more geographic probably. I mean, here's this mountain here. That's Beartown Mountain over there. That's October Mountain. That's Mount Riga. And you go on down in that way. And that's just, and people that know the valley wouldn't need to take that tour. The second one, which I think is one of the best, is the one that starts out right here in front of the watering trough. And then you go up the mountain, we go through the Willums, we get into the Willumsack Schist, and then we turn off, we make one stop, I forgot the first road that turns to the right up there now, I should know it. Cobble, no, not Cobble, the road past it. I have it here someplace, I can't even remember it now. But it's just off to the right. There's a little playground area there.
It's Roaring Oaks. Something.
I can't remember. I go by there all the time. Yeah. 200 yards up that road is Hanging Rock. And Hanging Rock is one of the best examples of a glacial erratic that I've seen in this valley. And you walk around and look at that, and you can't understand what's holding it there. I'd feel a little, yeah, don't do that, because you'll need another two at town hall if it rolls down the mountain. You don't want to go through that again. But it's really fascinating the way it's balanced, and that's certainly unique. And then at the top of the mountain, we stopped. This was all written up, so you can do it on your own. These are self-guided, although I do some of them myself. You stop at the mountain, and it's 1840, and you have to take yourself back to 1840 and recreate the, you can hear the noise, and then and what the hill looks like at night with all the charcoal fires going on, and the furnace like a small volcano, and all that sort of thing. Then from there goes up, quick look at the lake, and then just up the road about a quarter of a mile to Ball Peak, which is an easy walking distance in, except for a little climb at the end. There's a small glacial erratic there on the right as you go up that sits there, that's just on a little dome of rock. And it's not very big. It's probably about 8 feet across or so, nothing like the other one. And you get up on top of Ball Peak, and now you're standing on top of the Everett Schist, which used to live way off to the east of here somewhere, probably east of Rhode Island. I don't know how far it was pushed in. And they,
is that a track lightning?
No, I wouldn't. Well, any high spot will attract lightning, but it's more likely the trees would be hit on top of something like that.
Well, up there at top of Ball
Peak. Nice thing at Ball Peak, you don't have any trees, so. Well, Ball Peak is not the highest point. It's probably the best 360-degree view you're going to get. And we identify a lot of points from that in the valley and the valley on both sides. But you can also find glacial striations up there. Now, glacial striations are formed when the huge, heavy mass of ice with rocks trapped in the bottom of it scratches the bedrock and leaves grooves. But of course, a lot of these, the grooves are kind of worn away now, and the sunlight has to be just right. About between 10 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon, you can see it pretty well. And they run out of 65 degrees north toward west, which is just about the direction the glacier was going in this particular area. Then from there, we take them up, continue to over the border into Massachusetts. Incidentally, we always operate by Kirby's Law. State borders don't mean anything except location points, because they don't have anything to do with geology. They're usually divided arbitrarily or along a longitudinal line or something like that. And into Massachusetts, and then go down the hill by Bashbish Falls, which is not in our watershed, as I mentioned before. It drains in the opposite direction, and down all the way to Copaic Falls. And at Copaic Falls is a furnace down there, too. And the furnace down there is one you can really learn a lot from, because sections of it have fallen down, sadly enough. And you've got different layers exposed. You can see the casing inside, which is sort of egg-shaped and things like that. And you can see how they lined it with sand between the outside layer and the actual fire areas, and it's they're fascinating things, and you can see quite a bit of the industry there. Then back up the mountain again, over to the top of Mount Everett, which is the peak on Mount Washington. There are more glacial, a lot of glacial striations up there, running about 45 degrees out of the northwest, and that gives you a very good view of the one of the widest parts of the valley to the east from that point. And then from there down the mountain with some stops in between, and then it's the glacial trip from Egremont, from South Egremont, back down here to Salisbury to the Watering Trough. Watering Trough, incidentally, built of Stoppage marble, and I think 1908, I think it says on that. And then we recommend they have time enough left to come in and read up on some of the iron things here in the Scoville Library when they get back.
Those would be good tours. The reason I asked you about the lightning is I once was up there with a picnic just spread out and looked toward the Hudson, and a big storm was coming. And I tell you, we tore down.
I wouldn't sit up there, no. I understand that. Lightning's very tricky energy type of thing. And yes, I guess it would hit it, but I would think it would be more likely to hit the areas around it where there are trees than it would straight on top of the mountain, but I'm sure it's been hit.
No, I just wonder if there was something special in that rock that would attract lightning more than...
There's a certain amount of iron in it, but that's not... You're above the Willumsack, which has more iron in it. A lot of the rock on top of the mountain, you'll notice as you drive along, especially where it's weathered, is rusty. Mm-hmm. And that's because either the black mica, biotite mica, has a lot of iron in it, and it rusts when it weathers. And a lot of it is just limonite and pyrite and other iron materials. So there's iron in it.
Near the Sharon low-cost housing, is that a furnace?
That's a lime kiln. That's part of the old Sharon Valley Iron Company, and that's where they slake lime. And what they have when they get, again, stoppage marble, crush it so it's really calcium carbonate, and then they cook it. They'd cook it and get calcium, I guess it would be a calcium oxide, and that worked more efficiently in the furnaces. And the furnace for that one was partially torn down and then buried under the Sharon dump, sadly enough. And if you come from that kiln back toward Sharon Valley, you cross the 10-mile river, the Weebatuck Creek, and when the leaves are off the trees, you stand on the bridge and look upstream. You can see the old housing. It's sort of an arch made of stone, where the water wheel sat against the water in the river that turned the. Actually, it was in a little. It was like in a channel there. That turned the bellows that forced the hot air into the furnace. And that's about all you can see of it right now. Everything else is buried in it. The Valley Tavern that's the old Iron Company office.
Is it really?
Yeah. And that about 8 of these furnaces around here finally belonged to the Barnum Richardson Company. And Barnum Richardson were both Salisbury people. I think one was in Sharon for a while, but they lived in Lime Rock for a good part of their lives. And they did a lot with the iron industry. The Lime Rock furnace was a Barnum Richardson one, the Sharon Valley Iron Company, the Carmel Bridge Iron Company, which a lot of people don't realize existed, and you can still find foundations over there and things like that. That's why Carmel Bridge is there. The one in Lime Rock, there were 3 in East Canaan.
Yeah, there's one on the back road to 44.
Yeah, and I think that was the Beckley furnace.
All fenced in now?
Yes, it's a state historic site. And if you were going east on that road before you got there, there were 2 others before you got to that. So that was they were close to the lime, they were pretty close to iron, they had a lot of charcoal, so that was in good water power from the Blackberry River as well. And there's one in the North Kent area where the Sloan Stanley Museum is. And there's one in South Kent, one in Bulls Bridge, most people don't realize either. You know the covered bridge at Bulls Bridge? Where you get out and on the east side of the river, just get out and walk down about 200 yards. You don't even see it in there. And it's in there, and it's partially collapsed, so you can see a lot of the structure in that one, too. And then there's the one that probably remains in the best shape because it kept going the longest is the one in Richmond, Massachusetts. And the Richmond furnace, and that's in good shape. That's bigger than any of the furnaces around here. See, all you see when you see the old furnaces is just the stack, the furnace itself, and there were buildings all around these and bridges going to the top because they had to top load these things. That's why your iron masters are so important. They knew they'd use a mix of ore from several, up here in Riga, from several different ore pits, and just the right amount of charcoal, the right amount of limestone, right amount of time. You have to tap the slag off every now and then. So it was really quite a job.
Where did you learn this? Not here, England?
This started in England, yeah. And there were some furnaces, some iron industry. A lot of it was done in forges originally, much smaller operation. And that Eastern Massachusetts had them, I think, even in the late 1600s, which obviously came over from England at that point. So, but this was the center of it at one time. Which is really man using his geology when he gets into that.
How many people do you think lived up there during its peak?
I've read, and I really can't recall, but there were a lot of people up there. Which the whole thing, the different periods that we go through here is that I credit the geology with bringing a unique type of person to this valley, because you started out with mainly Englishmen who became Yankees after they got here. And then when the iron industry started, you had French charcoalers. The French are excellent charcoalers. A lot of Irish laborers. And then during the Revolution, after the Battle of Saratoga, when they were headed back south again, the British were defeated. And the Hessian troops were made up of a lot of Latvians, Lithuanians, and Estonians. And they dropped off the end of the line and went to Mount Riga, figured they had enough of this mercenary stuff and they're going to get a decent job. So you really, really bring in quite a combination of people. And you take a town like the little village of Housatonic, which is part of Great Barrington. the mix that you have there was Yankee entrepreneurs and Polish laborers that came over. That was their way over, was just to work there in the woolen mills and places like that. And so it's given us a marvelous mix in the valley. It's a unique area. I think I've seen a lot of areas in the United States and the world. I think it really stands out itself in being very unique.
Okay, why did the Italians come to Canaan?
I would think a lot of it's stonemasonry, building the furnaces, building the buildings out of Stockbridge marble. I think that probably doing the construction like that was probably the earliest part of it. A lot of it came when the there was another influx of both Italian people and Irish people in the so-called cottage stage of life in Stockbridge and Lenox, the Irish primarily as laborers. So we're talking now maybe 1870 to 19 till the Depression primarily, and there are so many of those huge buildings built. There was a real demand for the Italian skills in stonemasonry, and they were good. I mean, and I'm sure they were cheap. And you know, I think that's how a lot of people got here.
So a lot of those buildings, those cottages, are made of Stockbridge marble.
A lot of them are, right.
Now that you pointed it out to me.
Well, you start looking at them, and just because they're gray, don't let it fool you, because there's two different kinds of surfaces to a rock. There's a weathered surface, where it picks up, you know, just the acids. All raindrops carry a little bit of a carbonic acid in them, just from carbon dioxide, and that causes the discoloration of them. But if you scrape down in a little bit, or if you break off a piece of bedrock, it's always nice and clean and shiny on the inside. So that's one of the things that's difficult in the field, is telling one of these rock units from another. It's not simple. One other feature I might mention that may be of interest is the formation of caves up and down the valley. And there, Salisbury, again, has certainly got some of the most outstanding and magnificent, except most of them are on private property and you can't go there anymore. And I think I've been to most of them. I shouldn't put that on tape, probably.
That's all right.
Best examples are there's three caves on Cave Hill off of Between the Lakes Road.
Yeah, I know.
And there,
we won't say any closer than that.
We won't say any closer than that. And they go down through big sinkholes, and they're in the Malumsac Formation. The Malumsac is not quite as hard or compact as the Stockbridge Formation, and it's a marble limestone. And through years of groundwater, which is slightly acidic in this area, running down through cracks in the rock, it formed these caves. And at one time, there was a hotel over there that ran tours through the caves. If you go down in the Bashful Lady Cave, there's handrails in there, and there's old light fixtures, and they used to dress people up with flickers and hats and things like
that.
Where was the hotel? I think it was right on the edge of the lake, right in that area, because you're not very far from the lake there. And the Bashful Lady Cave, I believe, runs about 600 feet altogether. There's some pretty tough crawls in there, and it's no place for anyone that gets any claustrophobia. Then there's a second one called the Miles Cave, and there's a third one called the Jack in the Pulpit Cave, which is probably the most fun of all. You go way down and crawl through on your belly when it's dragging on your back above you, and then you climb up over a large room that's about 60 feet high and come out back near the top again. Then there's another one, the Indian Oven Cave over in town of Northeast, just off Route 22 a little way. And that's quite an interesting cave. That's about 400 feet altogether. That's got a main room, and that's about 60 feet high. And there are little caves like that up and down the valley. There's a number of them up over the valley in Massachusetts, and mainly on the west side of the valley in the Malumsac Formation. But you can find them in other places as well. Then there's some other kinds of caves that are not true caves, like rock fissure caves and things like Torrey Cave in Lenox, which is collapsed now. That was a rock fissure cave.